Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Hey guys, welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 276. All right guys, it's comedy crunch time. My stand-up comedy special, Mandroid, airs November 10th, Saturday night, November 10th at 11 p.m., 10 in the Central Time Zone, because you have to be different. And I really would love for you to watch it when it airs. Because in the old days in television, you had to watch stuff when it came on the television or you never saw it again. Scores of television lost forever because people just never watched it again. We've forgotten all the stuff we've forgotten. So, yes, please, watch the comedy special. I don't think it sucks. I'm actually really excited about it. I would love for you to see it. And then tweet at me if you don't like it. I'm sure you'll tell me. But if you like it, I'm fine with those tweets, too. I am fine with all of that. This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Guys, it's the future. You can buy and print official U.S. postage from your own computer and printer whenever you need it. Can you imagine what your great-great-grandfather would say? He'd be like, what's a computer? But that won't change the fact that you can print it out. It is way cheaper than a postal meter. You get more features than the meter for a fraction of the price. It's special discounts on mailing and shipping that you can't even get at the post office on things like Priority Mail and Express Mail. Stamps.com customers have printed over $3 billion in postage. Billion! With a B! So use Stamps.com. You get a special promo code, which is Nerdist, for an offer of a no-risk trial, $110 worth of bonus stuff, including a digital scale, and up to $55 of free postage. So go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the page and type in Nerdist. Stamps.com, enter the promo code Nerdist. This episode of the podcast is Anthony Edwards, who is so friggin' nice. It makes me happy. I can't tell you what the movie Revenge of the Nerds for me did when I was a kid. I think I've probably talked about this before, but we didn't have names for what we were, me and my friends, when I was growing up. And then I saw Revenge of the Nerds, and I was like, that's what I am, a tri-lam. But the nerd word, I wasn't really in use in my school until Revenge of the Nerds, and then I finally felt like I had a tribe that I could identify with. Because there were only, like, maybe three of us or four of us. Well, maybe that's an exaggeration. I guess if you counted all of the grades, they were, like, maybe 10 or 11. Which we saw each other in chess club and computer lab. So it was Revenge of the Nerds was a strangely influential film for me, and made me happy. And I've seen it hundreds of times. I'm talking a lot about Revenge of the Nerds. I know Anthony Edwards has done more stuff than that, but I'm very excited about that one. But Top Gun, come on, gotcha. Come on, ER. His new show is called Zero Hour. It's a mid-season replacement on ABC coming early next year. And just a wonderful guy. Ladies and gentlemen, Gilbert Lowe. I'm sorry, I'm doing it again. It's Anthony Edwards. The Tri-Lam. President of the Adams College. Tri-Lams. Anthony Edwards. Anthony Revenge of the Nerds. Damn it!
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hey Okay. Blah, blah, blah. I'm setting the levels.
Talking
about it, just so there's not weird moments of silence where we're staring at each other awkwardly.
Wondering.
Perfect. Great. Now we're recording.
Anthony Edwards, thank you for having me in your apartment. I'm sitting across from your desk from you, so I sort of feel like I'm being interviewed.
You are.
What are your...
But I'm technically interviewing you. So why do you think you should have this job? What qualities make you feel like you're...
I feel like I've pretended long enough. It's time for you to take over. I'm passing the mantle and pretending.
What?
Over.
Okay.
From the oldest nerd to the youngest.
Well, okay, let's just dive right in and talk about that, because a lot of people say that I get asked constantly in interviews, like, what's the difference between a geek and a nerd? And I go, well, look, people, it's a semantic. I don't know. I think ultimately we're saying the same thing. Some people would, if you want to get granular, say, well, nerds are more, you know, tech, and geeks are more this, and, you know, everyone has their own definition. And I say, look, we didn't use the word geek when I was growing up. It was regional. And the nerd was really a word that I didn't start using until Revenge of the Nerds, where I saw it and went, oh, that's it. That's what I am. Right. So it was because of your movie that I mean, I had just been into video games, and I was chess club and computers, and I just didn't know what that... You don't ask what that's called when you're a kid. You just like what you like.
Yeah. Because, like, what year was that? It was, like...
82, maybe?
Yeah, or something. Yeah.
82, 83, maybe? 80,
somewhere right in there. And it was, like... I mean, it was funny. It also had, you know, very little... It had a little bit to do with techno, but it had more had to do with just, like, being out of it. You know,
yeah.
Being not the jock.
Yeah.
Where that was such the, you know, everything was about sports and you know, nerds were anybody who didn't fit in.
Yeah, but I just don't think it really took the... Because I always kind of wonder, like... Well, what were nerds in the 1800s? Were they cartographers? Like, I don't know. Maybe they were accountants. They still had to count money at some point. I don't know what they did. I mean, I guess they were scientists and budding astrophysicists. But it wasn't really until the computer revolution, the home computer revolution, started to take off in the 70s, where you had a whole generation of people that finally, maybe nerds were just waiting for their thing
in
history.
Right. Well, anytime like a group gets ostracized anyway, and then turns, you know, the negative into a positive,
yeah.
It turns it into a badge of courage.
Yeah.
You know? That was the whole joke and fun of it. I mean, that was, you know, to have like, what was it called? The black fraternity. The Tri-Lamps showing up and making this whole black power reference to, you know, alignment. So,
which was a... such a great that moment in the movie, like any kid is like, oh my god, yeah, because I think so much of our culture leading up to that point, particularly in film, was a sort of like I don't know, I guess it was like post-war era, like, yeah, America, like people win who are strong and are like, they, you know, they're, it's all physical. And then to have a movie suggest that, oh yeah, actually the smart people actually can use their brains rather than beating the shit out of something until it submits. You know, like that was such an important idea for us, I think.
And especially probably at the age you were.
Yeah.
I mean, you were what?
12.
12 years old.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there you are, like, trying to figure out who you are and what you are, and, you know. You know, it was just in a time when they were just making ridiculous movies, you know. And that was one in which the director, Jeff Kinnear, was like, yeah, but this is a ridiculous movie with a heart. And, you know, he was right. I mean, it really was. So.
Was it a pretty strict script? Was there improvising? Did you guys...
It was pretty much there. But, you know, we were all just actors looking for a job. And
yeah.
So, you know, everybody just dove in. And you know, to this day, I'll run into Tim Busfield. And, you know, there's friendships that came out of that,
yeah.
That really, you know, it was our kind of first jobs for a lot of us. And it was fun.
But you were in Fast Times, too.
Yeah.
So that was another defining film of the...
Yeah, I've been lucky to be around some movies that were like that. Fast Times, once... I mean, I was, what, 18? Eric Stoltz and I, we grew up together in Santa Barbara.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and my family all... Like, my brothers all surfed in that whole world. But Yeah, we were all like, I think I was like 6 months into college or something, and that job came up, and you know, Sean Penn was insanely brilliant, of course, you know, and let's never forget that he was like introduced us to who he based the character on, and he was nothing at all like Spicoli, and you're like, wow, and you realize like, right, like, you know. Actors, it's not about, you know, imitating something as much as finding that thing that makes it real. Because that's a really unbelievable character he came up with. I mean, Sean Penn, like, you know, was so not that guy. And was so brilliant, so.
But he was, that sort of like, that kind of burner who then, I mean, like, he really, that character's pretty timeless.
Yeah.
And it was almost like our culture didn't know we needed that character until he did it. And people are still doing that character 30 years later. And it just seems like, how do you keep doing that?
Well, it's so funny. I'm doing this new show now. And the camera, the DP, is this guy, John Leonetti. And John Leonetti was the focus puller on Fast Times at Ridgemont
High. Holy shit.
So we haven't seen each other in 30 years.
Oh, my God.
And John Leonetti is literally, he's a lovely guy. But I'm sitting, he's like, namaste, brother. And he's like, I mean, he's this classic California character.
Yeah.
And it totally brought me back to Fast Times in that world. Because here he is, this, like, you know. Full-on California character. These guys, I mean, that's why I grew up in Santa Barbara, and it was like, you know, those guys, it was like, as long as they could have a job cleaning pools and able to surf, then life was set.
That's,
you know, that's as much as they wanted out of it.
What else do you need?
Yeah, what else?
This is just sort of the classic parable about the guy who goes to the Mexican fishing village and they're catching fish, and he meets these old villagers and he's like, oh, if you had more people come in, you could catch more fish. And the guy's like, and then what? And then you could build a factory and you could employ a lot of people and then you could do... And then he basically keeps saying, and then what, and then what, and then what. And he's like, and then you'd have free time to fish. And he's like, yeah, but I do that now.
Exactly.
So why do I have to do all that stuff to get what I already have?
Yeah, it's that funny thing. I mean, Santa Barbara's a beautiful, great place, but it's also a place that, like, you know, you're not gonna really push yourself. Because you don't have to. Because you really can't set up. I mean, I remember being people being like in a hot tub by the beach or something like that. This is the center of the universe.
Yeah.
Because there's no more beautiful place. And there's no more, you know. And you kind of get lulled into, you know, just a real.
Yeah, it's not like if you're in Santa Barbara. A lot of times people, wherever they are, they sort of dream about the other side of the fence. But if you're in Santa Barbara, it's not like you're going, I wonder what it's like to live in a cramped apartment in a noisy city.
That's what I said. I was like, no. I mean, Santa Barbara as a kid, you know, sometimes the fog would roll in. And
get,
you know.
Seriously.
It'd be rough like that.
Work shuts down.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
But Santa Barbara is an interesting... There's sort of this interesting dichotomy between, like, this really pleasant beach culture and then there's kind of a douchebag contingency, too. A little, like, drunk, you know, like that...
Well, it was the one place on the 101.
I guess because of the schools.
And then the 101, also, it was the one place where there were stoplights. So it was like, when I grew up there in the 60s, 70s, that for everybody hitchhiking, that was people would get dropped and let off. So it was a huge homeless community that started in Santa Barbara. So that's always been there. It's been like, you know, it's in a resort town. So
right.
It's got, always has had a population like that has just hung out. And at UCSB, I mean, it's got the university.
There is kind of a bro culture there of, like, party bros you know, like, sorority girls and stuff. It's, you know, that's sort of around. But there's so many great, like, the Montage is really nice and, all the little resorts around there.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful... I mean, my folks still live there. And, you know, my dad was born there.
Montecito.
And he was an architect and, you know, built all kinds of beautiful things. And, I mean, it was a really good place to grow up. I mean, tons of theater. We had, like, you know, two different youth theater groups going on, and I was like this scrawny little kid, so as much as I wanted to play sports, I couldn't really because they laugh at me. And so I found, like, theater, and I danced but there was enough of it going on that, you know, by the time I got out of high school, I'd done 25 shows. So, like, we had just, it was just normal for us to have all that. So, I mean, it was a great community that way. For access to the arts, as they say.
So what happened right after Revenge of the Nerds, which I'm still going to keep saying is one of my favorite movies of all time. What is, you know, coming off of that, because that movie... I guess maybe they didn't... it was fucking huge. I remember how huge that movie was.
Right.
And I, you know, there had been since Animal House, like a string of teen comedies or, you know, Fast Times and you're so into that. And, you know, there were a lot of other, I mean, I have vague memories of, you know, a lot of misfit teen comedy, but that one just like hit the sweet spot. So it was a huge movie. So afterwards, was it sort of like, oh, now I can be in...
Well, yes, and not really. I mean, I was also, you know, I've never been like a real leading man kind of actor that, oh, Revenge of the Nerds. Because there was always, and they're friends and they're great. I mean, there's always the Rob Lowe's and the, you know, those are the guys I was with when I was, so I
the
was
Alpha
always
Beta
getting,
House.
I was getting, you know, kind of what everybody else didn't get is what my career kind of has always been in a great way. I'm very luckily, you know, not, but, it did. I mean, that it led to Gotcha, which was the same director, Jeff Canoe. So we had this great.
Oh, Jeff! I didn't know he directed
that.
Yeah,
yeah.
Had the biggest crush on Linda Fiorentino.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. Who didn't? And so that led to Gotcha, and Gotcha is really what led to. That's what Tony Scott saw and said, "Oh, well, that's the guy you want to have as your best friend to die." So you know, it was that because the studio really wanted a comedian. They wanted Goose to be a comedian. And I was, and to the point where when I my first day of shooting, I got a basket, a fruit basket from the head of the studio. Both of them, it was Ned Tan and Don Still, and the little card along with it said, Goose may not always be wise, but he's always, underlined three times, funny. And I'm like, oh, wait, I got to go look at the script again. Because
leave us your memory. I have to send you a fucking gift with a note on it, like giving you notes about your character.
Before we start the movie, and I'm like, and I'm thinking, oh, no. Like, okay, I knew, like, he wanted... But that was the, so every day was about trying to, you know, bring funny into it. And I'm not a comedian and I'm not a writer, but I mean, I know, I mean, I like to laugh. And so, but then, I mean, I got into that, but it's just like how things lead to the next. It's strange.
Goose got Meg Ryan though.
Right.
So he was, so like funny does get the ladies.
Right. And it does go full circle because my son did wake me up the other night to tell me that I was referenced in New Girl because Schmidt said, oh, yeah, oh, you're watching Top Gun. Oh, it's Anthony Ed, he called me. Anthony Ed. He says, nobody dies like him. He's like the bald Hillary Swank. As a 50-year-old father of five who's made a lot of, you know, luckily made some good movies and a lot of bad ones, it's like that was a very proud moment that your son is actually
Bald Hillary Swank.
Exactly, which is like, because it's like, you know, I am the one you want to kill. You know,
I
like him enough to kill him.
I was, you know, I was also like, Top Gun was a good sweet spot for me too because I was teenage, you know, I was like early teenager at that point. And of course, you know, everyone identified with Maverick, but I identified with Goose because I felt like I was. That I never saw myself as like, I'm the guy who's gonna,
exactly.
I'm gonna pilot this bird into the sunset. You know, I'm the guy who's like, hey, tits. You know, like I was that guy.
I know how to operate the radios.
Yeah, wee, stop it.
That's what they call the guy in the back. They call him Gibbs. It's like, because there's nothing to fly the plane in the back of it, it's just radar and all that stuff. So it was really meant for guys like us who could just be like, hang out with a good looking one.
But there was not a dry eye in the house.
That's right.
When Goose hit that ejection thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
Oh, it was all over.
That's why I got my pilot's license last year, finally. Oh, after
holy
all,
shit.
I love flying. I've always loved it and everything. So
even
finally,
after that experience?
I know. So finally, and that's what, and when you get your, when you do your first solo flight, they do this tradition where you cut off the back of your shirt to, so that it's called, because they used to in the old days, that's how they trained you. They'd be behind you and they'd pull on your shirt.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
So that was, so the tradition is a cut because you don't need them back there anymore.
Okay,
to tell
okay.
you where to fly. And then you can write something to your instructor because you get to, you know, fun solo. So that's what, I think I wrote something to the effect of, Goose lives, I finally kicked the good-looking guy out of the plane. It's like, you know, if only he wasn't flying, I would have lasted a long time.
Dude, there was so much, like, when you look at, like, so when you look at the volleyball sequence, you're like, there's so much male actor testosterone in that scene between Tom Cruise and Val Kilmer. And just like,
and as my kids also point out, who's the only one with a shirt on?
Our dad.
I would have been that guy. Yeah. Was it Rick Rossovich? Rick Rossovich was like just all these fucking shirtless dudes.
Yeah, it was all greased up.
Not all of them have held up, by the way. Tom Cruise is fine.
Everybody
else would still want to play shirtless volleyball. You look like you're in pretty decent shape. I think now is Goose's time.
Exactly. I had the age. I'm like an old red wine. Oh God, that was a ridiculous time. That movie and that hall, because everybody knew what we were doing. So it was like, you know, it was really a silly story. It was really pretty silly. And it was a summer in San Diego that was a little twisted. There was a tremendous amount of tequila drunk.
But that's fun. That's a whole different kind of. I mean, like, you know, your background's theater. You're taking a lot of acting movie roles, and like you just said, like everyone knew what this was. But it's still, you still kind of gotta like it though, because it's sort of, it does feed a little bit of that. Oh, I think this is going to be like a big movie.
Oh yeah, I know, and had that too. I mean, it was. I mean, the joke was that like we couldn't shoot the planes because Tony Scott had to have like lever. You know, everything had to have like blinds with smoky light coming through, right? So like and you know, fans to blow it all and make it look good. It was like, well, we can't, you know, land a plane without smoke and fans and like, you know, everything had to be backlit, and it was all about. I mean. On Tony Scott's birthday, while we were making the movie, the producers gave him a dildo with wings on it. And that was his present. I mean, it was like, no one was pretending that they were making an art film. Bruckheimer and Simpson knew what they wanted.
How did he take that?
He loved it. It was like, that's it, because that's what he would, you know, Tony, he was like, yeah. It's fucking rock and roll. It's rock and roll. More patches. Put more patches.
What do they mean? I don't give a shit. Plane.
I don't care. Put more patches on it and have it loose. And it's like, but you know, when you fly, you have to be all tight. I don't care. You know, you want
well,
it all.
Yeah, really.
And that was what made it all great. He was fired 3 times during that movie.
Really?
Yeah, he would be fired because the studio wanted me to be a comedian also wanted the movie to be really, you know, straightforward. And he wanted all the stuff that made it look great. All that slow motion, all that backlit, smoky stuff that made it so cool.
Well, yeah, he was basically capitalizing at the zenith of MTV culture.
Right, exactly.
So it was basically like a gorgeous music video.
And they hired the guy who did The Hunger. I mean, if you ever saw The Hunger, I mean, that is like the sexiest, you know, it's Susan Sarandon and it's nothing but like dappled light through, you know, smoky, sex-filled rooms. So it was, you know, and then when we finally saw it, we were like, oh, yeah, this, I mean, it was, and you put in all that music and that ridiculousness and, you know, it is that thing where I do shy because I'm, you know, of course, you know, Mr. Mellow Pacifist, who then has to spend the next 30 years having people going, my child joined the Navy because of you. And you're like, I'm sorry and I'm glad and I hope they're flying planes and not scraping paint off of the wall of the...
Which is what you would end up doing.
Yeah, I mean, when we were on the aircraft carrier, literally, they're like, oh, you're making a movie? It's no fucking adventure. Right?
Yeah.
And they're like, got a spoon, and they're literally scraping paint. Like, that's what they're doing on it. You know, the life expectancy of an aircraft carrier in a conventional war is 4 hours.
Oh, wow.
So we have, like, this whole antiquated, you know, military system. I mean, it's like, it's what the debate is now, right? It's what they were talking about last night.
They're
like, you know, do we really need another aircraft carrier? I don't
How
think.
Many?
Yeah.
But was there any, was there, was everyone cool? Was there hanging out on the set?
No, everybody got along really well. And it was literally, you know, just destroying kind of one hotel room after another of where the party was or what was happening. And, you know, it was, I mean, the greatest character on that is this actor, Barry Tubb,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, who's the Texan with the cowboy hat. And, you know, he was proud because he said, I'm Barry Tubb, Dub Tubb's son. And he was like, I don't care. I'm going to eject. When we go up.
and you know, you guys are all a bunch of pussies. I'm gonna eject.
Like, you know, then we see the dailies of his footage while we're, you know, we had like they shot us in the plane while we were flying, and he's just there like getting greener and greener and greener. And then just like, completely lost.
See, they should put that on the DVD extras. They've got to put the throwing up on the DVD extras.
It's all that total false bravado. I mean, but that's like this day you would never go up in an airplane now. Like then, like you literally had to film. You know, with all the, there's not full CGI.
Sure.
Like it is now. So, you know, they were like, it was worth it to them to put us through, like, you know, training to get backseat qualified so they could get, like, 7 minutes of film of us in the backseat of an airplane.
Oh, wow.
So that was cool.
Actors have it so much easier now.
Now
not like the old days where they used to have to get up and
play. Yeah, that's what I was going to do for the Saturday Night Live sketch, would be the veterans of foreign war films.
We had to start a war with a group of actors from another country.
Exactly. Just there was a day our per diem was late. It was
awful. You know, there a movie that I loved when I was younger was Mr. North. I loved that movie.
Yeah.
Really fun movie.
That was a totally melancholy summer in that it was John Huston's, like, it was his kind of favorite book, and the book Theophilus North was published after Thornton Wilder died.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't totally edited, so I had some problems there, but it was, you know, John Huston had done these movies for his children. He did The Dead for his son Tony Huston, and he did I forget the other one for Princey's Honor or something, I think, for Angelica, and then he'd done this was for his son Danny to direct, who's now a great actor.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know Danny Huston. Oh, he didn't direct that.
He directed Mr. North.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was going to be a director, and then, you know, didn't realize what a great actor he was. So he ended up becoming a great actor. But so this was for Danny, and John passed away while we were making the movie. So we're shooting in Newport, Rhode Island. But he was such a great character. My favorite picture I have is I'm sitting on a deck in Rhode Island just going over the script with him. And it was the same day that Lauren Bacall came over for dinner.
I
sat at this dinner while Lauren Bacall and John Huston are like, oh, remember the day that Bogey did this on the set of African Queen? And you're just like, my jaw is just like, I can't believe I'm hearing
jeez,
this stuff.
Jeez, name droppers.
I know. Exactly. Oh, you had to sleep with him?
Oh, jeez.
But it was, and he... Before the night that he died, he knew he was going to die. I mean, he was that kind of a guy because he had this the person who took care of him, who was also, I believe, his partner. He told her, when I die tonight, don't let them know until 7 o'clock, so they have a good night's sleep because they're going to have to shoot that day.
Oh, like, my God,
he was, you know, an amazing. You know, and he also had to, the big lesson to me on that one was that he had to struggle to make that movie. Like, here's John Huston, wants to make a movie, and he was doing the same thing that everybody's doing, like, begging to get the $6 million so that he can go make, like, you'd think, after all the movies that man's made, they're like, here, Mr. Huston, would you like another $1 million to make
your
movie?
Oh, my God.
But every movie he made was something that was important to him, and when it's important to you, it's not commercial. It's just kind of inherent to that.
Yeah.
Until then it hits, and people go, oh, we knew that it was going to be great.
Yeah.
So, you know, he, to his last movie, to his last dying day, was proving once again that it's supposed to be hard. It's not supposed to be given to you. And, you know, if it's worth it, you fight for it, and, you know, and you get it done. I mean, it's like what you read about Ben Affleck now with his movie Argo, which I saw the other night, which is great. And it's like, he fought hard and hard and hard and, you know, just didn't compromise.
Well, I guess, yeah, because if it were easy, then... I mean, obviously anyone can make stuff now, but it's still really hard to make a feature film and have it get released.
Right.
And if it's good on top of that, well, that's a bonus. Like, it just, like, it's so hard. That whole process is so insane, and it takes years. Like, I don't know how
anything... And whether someone's going to give you $1 million or $40 million, they're not going to do it easily. You know,
right.
They're never going to give it. And that's where, you know, these making these $80, $90, $150 million movies, they're like, yeah, it better be based on a book and a comic series and a, you know, because for their, you know, business-wise, it doesn't make sense.
Right.
You just can't, you know, justify... Oh, yeah. You know, look at the odds. It's fantastic how much money people get back from their film investments.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I mean, like, even some of the movies that you think of as, like, the highest grossing films, they go, well, they still haven't made their money back. Like, how is that possible?
No, I mean, Revenge of the Nerds, we all had points, you know, there were net points, but I've never gotten a dime from that movie.
God. You know, all that years. It all just goes back in. And
the same, yeah, it's the same. Tom Wilson had the same thing with Back to the Future.
Right.
Where it's like, really? This movie made hundreds of millions of, like, oh, we're still in the red.
Yeah, exactly.
How? How are you still in the red?
Advertising in Korea the 18th DVD release is sucking up all the money.
Points. Yeah, it didn't even mean anything. I guess it means something.
But the truth is, the other fun thing about the movie business that way is that financially is I got involved in motor racing just as a fan and then did some charity work with it. And when you're around that world and you're around the businesses of America that have nothing to do with the movie business, is you're like, oh, right, this is like tractors. The tractor business, which is probably 10 times the size of Hollywood.
Of course.
You know, and they make tractors. But when you call the head of John Deere, he returns your call. Like, it's a whole other, like, the whole, everything's out of line.
Yeah.
You know, it's like this, it's like my dogs. It's like they think they're big, you know? There's like these tiny chihuahuas. And they're, it's laughable.
Oh, Anthony's dogs are the tiniest, most adorable dogs ever. Yeah. A black one and a white one.
Little chihuahuas.
When I came into your house, you were like, oh, okay, be careful of the dogs. I'm like, oh boy, and I turn the corner, just like, yip, 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 yip.
Exactly.
So you're into motor car racing?
I am. I'm a fan. I'm a huge, like, I'm a fan of it. It's just, you know, my one little.
Like NASCAR?
Actually, Formula One.
Formula One.
And, yeah, Formula Cars.
Explain it to me, because I've been kind of snobby about it before. I'm like, what is it? It goes from there to there. What do you need? What is it? What do you see in it?
I guess it's as silly as the fact that I got to drive in, like, the celebrity race in Long Beach years ago. And when you get into a car and you learn how to drive it fast and you realize that it's about putting together 10 corners really well and you have to do it precisely and what the concentration's involved, then you realize the talent of it that required to make a car go that fast. So it just becomes that. It was just that. And then, you know, I've always liked cars. I've like, you know, and it's just kind of my one, it's my one little dad private time.
The kids all
hate it, so I get to do it by myself.
But someday they'll come around. Right. And be like, you know, like, I hated country music when I was growing up because I grew up in the South and my dad used to listen to it all the time.
Right.
When I got older, I kind of like it a little bit.
Yeah, it's funny. But it's also, it has to do with, I mean, now the charity work I'm doing now has to do with Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I don't know if you heard, but...
Oh, you're building a hospital.
Yeah, well, we took a year off as a family and we just did a dream come true trip, which is we took the kids out of school and we went around the world for a year.
Holy shit.
And we traveled for, 310 days with two teachers and went around the world. And we ended up spending a lot of time in Africa and hadn't been there before. And... like people who go to Africa, they come back going, "It's where we're from. It's the Holy Land." I mean, because it feels that way. I mean, you get into the Serengeti, or you get in these places where, you know, or the coasts of Africa, where for 40 million years turtles have been coming and laying eggs. Like, it's a very central place to where humanity comes from.
I know, but in Los Angeles, some buildings date back to 1923.
Exactly, that's what I grew up.
So it's probably the same. It's pretty similar, right? Yeah, pretty similar to that.
It's pretty similar. and there's an incredible spirit. I mean, Kenya is a country, and the people, and there's the thing as far as, you know, as actors, you always like doing charity, and how do you make things, how do you make a difference in what you do? And the kind of thing that really seduced me into Africa too is how little goes so far. You know, I mean, we're building the first public children's hospital for East Africa, and we've raised $2 million to do that. I mean, if we were to do something on the same scale here, it would be $120 million to build this hospital. And this hospital, not only can we do it, but they don't have any pediatric teaching facility in East Africa. None. I mean, it's like, here we are in New York City, where, like, you can't throw a rock without hitting a hospital or a doctor's office or something, you know.
Right.
And that kind of... need there is exciting when you can help, you know, feed it. So that's what's, it's just been really inspiring for me. And I'm a big runner. Actually, that's kind of what I do, is I run. And it's through the sport of running that we're doing this, because the man who started this was a ex-professional runner who started bringing shoes down to his teammates and people he ran with in Africa where he trained, in Kenya in particular. And so the organization is called SHU for Africa. And what we do is we do women's empowerment races where we get 2,000 women together, give them a pair of shoes and a t-shirt, and then at that event have AIDS education and health initiatives at the event, or do it with a school, and we're building, you know, we're building schools there for $60,000.
Oh my God.
So you're taking a public school and you're, which is falling apart because they have to have these schools and they have to provide the teachers, but the quality of the building is so poor, and so to do that basic infrastructure actually completely transforms education for that community, because the schools become a place that the kids and the teachers want to go to.
Sure.
And that's simply by having doors and windows and a roof, which are things, more things that like we can't even perceive, you know. And I started this with the story of going around the world because what inspired this is, if you go away from this country for, like what we did, 300 days, or if you probably only take you about 2 or 3 weeks, if you really pay attention, you come back, you realize, like, we have so much excess.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's insane, the amount of excess. The fact that our roads are paved so well, most of the world doesn't have roads. Healthcare, education, all this stuff that we whine and moan about as thinking, we have so much extra. I mean, we're killing ourselves with food, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like we spend more in this country combating obesity. If we took that money that we combat obesity with, we can feed Africa.
God. We're a Cheesecake Factory culture.
Yeah.
But what's so interesting is like the whole like 99.1% thing in America. You go, yeah, but America is like the 1% of the planet.
Yeah.
As a whole, we have so much.
We consume way too much. And
yeah. How is Africa? I mean, Africa's, there, you know, I've traveled the United States like 100 times over. I've been pretty much everywhere a lot.
Right.
Global traveling, I've been to Costa Rica, I've been to Australia, I've been to, you know, Switzerland, Italy, England, you know, not any place. Really want to go to Asia, really, you know, I thought about Africa, and, but it's just, like, how well educated about the regions do you need to be to go into, and what's safe, what's not safe, like, what do you...
It's really worth going. I mean, literally, you know, if you start in any capital city in Africa, you're going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's closer than you think. I mean, it's 7 hours to London from here, and then it's 8 hours directly south to Nairobi, and you're in Nairobi. Africa's huge, and with very little research and very little exploration, you would find safe places to go.
And I hate to sound like a dumb American when I say that, but I just mean in terms of like, I know that there are, you know, I know that there are uprisings and rebellions in certain parts of the country. And so you just want to make sure like, and I think I'm a little of where kind of America's at in the world stage right now. I feel like there are places like it's maybe not the best to go as an American.
Yeah, but the most of the conflict that I've ever been around or seen in Africa is not like classic white on black conflict that you'd think of like, oh, you're not from this continent, we need to kill you. It's tribal, it's just basic conflicts that happen between countries that happen everywhere that are very specific to that region. And I think it would be very difficult to stumble in to something that was bad. It's like, you know, yes, there's malaria in Africa, but you don't have to take malaria pills everywhere you go in Africa because there are specific places where it exists, and you can take the pills when you're in that area.
I mean, it's just the same kind of dumb thing that, you know, I admittedly have that, and it's not just Africa specific, it's everywhere. It's like, oh, well, if I go to Korea, which part of Korea would I want to make sure to go into? When we went to
Costa Rica. But that's why you have to travel, because you've got to take that general stereotype and get it defined specific.
You know, like people from the Midwest go, well, how do you live in L.A.? That's crazy and not safe. And you're like, you just go, I don't know, you figure it out.
Right,
you know?
Right. And that's the thing that most countries that are actually touching other countries have, is that people, you know, learn how to do that. They know how to travel around.
Yeah.
And Americans can really benefit from that because, you know, we're so isolated.
Well, I think that's really important to do. And it's amazing that you got to take your kids to go see that too.
Yeah, and we continue to do it. You know, we continue to travel. Because that's the thing. Once you get there once, you'll go back again.
Yeah.
You know, and you'll go and you'll realize that, you know, it's you can kind of get anywhere in the world in 24 hours. And, you know, it's a long time, but it's a plane ride that has a beginning, middle, and end, you know?
Well, it's just a day. Yeah, it's a day. Like, I, you know, yeah. I got up at 8 this morning. You know, tomorrow by tomorrow morning, I could be somewhere
And you'll
else.
Never regret it. You'll never regret traveling. That's for sure.
Well, it's funny because when I traveled internationally the most, I was dating a girl who was on the show that you are on now, Jacinda Barrett.
Oh, okay.
So Jacinda is the one, like, Jacinda's Australian, and she had this, she was very much a traveler, and so, you know, she's like, we have to go to Costa Rica. I'm like, I don't know what's there. She's like, that's why you gotta go. Like, yeah, you know, yeah. I don't know why. I just grew up very, we traveled around America, but my parents were not big international travelers. And so I just didn't really appreciate the value of seeing another culture.
Right.
Until I went and right. experienced it.
Yeah. Well, that's you're not alone in that. I mean, that's like, it's a pretty common American.
I know, but you know, I always like to, I'm sure like most people, I like to feel like, oh, I'm enlightened. But then I realize I'm not really. You know, like I know I have my own little sheltered world, but I really haven't seen most of what's out. It's sort of like,
what's exciting is that as this whole, this internet and everything, I mean, the way everybody's communicating now, because you literally now, we could be talking live to a bunch of kids in Africa like that. You know, you just couldn't do that before. So I think as younger generations are doing that, it's going to open up, you know, borders in a lot.
Yeah.
You know, in a big way.
By the way, you and Jacinda should talk because she also has, well, she had her pilot's license.
No, I know. We talked about that.
Oh, you did? Yeah.
Yeah. She used to fly. I don't know if she's flying now, but yeah, I love it. I'm obsessed with it. It's so much fun.
What kind of planes do you fly?
Just a little single engine. I fly a Cirrus now.
Yeah.
And, out of white planes and just kind of have a day off, I'm out and flying and I love it. It's really good.
Do you go anywhere, or do you just kind of circle around and then come right away?
I stay within 500 feet of the airport at all times. Yeah, I mean, the East Coast is great. I mean, go up to Maine and, you know, and have lunch. And I'm the classic, like, go have lunch places, you know, flip pilot. I, like, go to Nantucket for lunch or on Monday.
Oh, that's so much fun.
Go see my friend in York, Pennsylvania, and we'll go for a run and then fly back. And people are like, oh, that's a good environmental thing to do.
Ah, shit.
Fly a plane to go for running.
I know you... That's so funny. Like, you accomplish this huge task, which is you learn how to fly a plane, and then there's still always going to be someone who's like, wait, nice carbon footprint. Oh, yeah, exactly. Come on. Yeah, you know, I put a lot of work into that. Come on.
No, it's just a really good, it's a good hobby because it requires all this concentration, and yet it's beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, they let actors do it.
It is the one thing that they'll let you.
Yeah, that was the thing when I did my first solo, and the terrifying thing wasn't doing the flight, it was when he got out of the plane before I took off, and I'm thinking to myself, wait a second, I'm just pretending I've learned how to fly this. I don't really know how to do it.
All right, that's when the acting skills come in.
Yeah,
come on, you're a pilot. I also love running, but
have you run any marathons?
No, I haven't. I don't know if I could call myself a runner, but I run a lot. It's just like treadmill running because I'm usually just in hotels.
But that's a great thing. And I'm not an advocate of marathons. I mean, I've done them, but I wouldn't recommend them. I recommend doing them once just for the self-esteem you gain to know you've done it. But I mean, that kind of distance is not great for you.
Sure.
For most people, like I'm tall and, you know, after 20 miles, my body's like, sit the fuck down. Stop that. But just like, you know, like today, I just went out and did, you know, 4 miles in the park, 5 miles in the park, and you're set for the day, right? You never regret.
No. But
feel better.
What's so funny is making the... Because I can run...
See, we could have done this running.
We could have run the whole time.
No, next time. We'll do it.
But what I found is that if anyone's an indoor treadmill runner, the transition... You can feel awesome, like, oh, I could run forever on a treadmill. And then you go outside and you get like 2 blocks, and you're like, fuck.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, I think there's something about propelling yourself, like the treadmill, the moves that go forward, but propelling yourself forward is an extra exertion.
Yeah, I mean, I started running on treadmills when I started. I mean, I was like 37 years old. I smoked. I was like, okay, I'm going to do something I can't do, which is run. And I started treadmills. And once you get off treadmills and then start running, then you'll only go to treadmills when it's
raining or crappy weather, right, or you're stuck in a hotel. Because once you get running outside and enjoying it, it's really fun. Because it's just so... It's a great way to zone out without having to concentrate.
Do you have earbuds? Do you just like the world?
No, I just kind of like the world and just kind of, you know, because I always have whatever thought I have before I run, it's different after. You come back and you have a different, you know. And you can really, it's meditative in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is.
Well, New York has a good, I mean, L.A. is...
I'll show you. Next time, whenever you're back, I'll take you and we'll run cool. the bridle path.
Oh, I'd love
it's
to.
It's great, because it's really nice, and you don't have to run on cement.
That's really cool. Yeah, it's harder to run in Los Angeles because it's not a well-planned city,
right,
and so you find yourself, like... I mean, it's certainly possible,
right?
But it just doesn't connect very well.
Right. So first marathon I ran, I did it while I was in L.A. I was on ER, and I did it, and I would like run it like Hollywood, and it would be like mind-numbing to go around that so many times,
over and over.
But it's good here, and but that's the thing is, you know, it's really about moderation because, you know, as people get like, you know, get too obsessed and think, oh, if I'm going to run, I have to run a marathon. It's
right.
Like, no. Just go out 20 minutes,
yeah,
15 minutes, and then do that three times a week and see how it feels, and then it'll grow naturally.
I mean, it is kind of, running is sort of it can be hard on your body. I mean, like, it's basically, it's sort of, you know, I guess one way to look at it is that, you know, every time your feet smack on the ground, you're sort of like, you're punching your organs a little bit.
Well, yeah, and we also, it's, you know, I don't know if you read Born to Run or any of those books, but the most important thing is to run on the balls of your feet.
Yeah.
If you don't run on, if you keep landing on your heel, that's where people get injured and hurt.
Because
we're not meant to do that.
Do you have the gorilla feet shoes or do you have running shoes?
I have running shoes and I have both, but the point of the running shoes, which are the, you know, the Vibrams or whatever they call them, those, is that you have to run the way you're supposed to run, which is to land on the balls of your feet. Like, if you're barefoot, you're not going to land on your heels.
Right.
You're just not going to. And if you run in that posture, which is harder at first because you have to use more muscles, it's better for you ultimately because it's less shocking and jarring on everything.
Oh, and so running shoes are supposed to spread a little bit.
Yeah, really soft heel running shoes have probably caused more damage than... prevented.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because you're getting the repetition of beating that's going straight from your heel through the rest of your body as opposed to hitting on the ball of your foot.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I have the Nike chip in the shoe, and then it connects to the
phone
track the runs and stuff.
Yeah, no, I've got it too. I've got my Nike watch, and I love that. I love going like getting on the maps and seeing where it went. And,
that's really nice. Yeah, okay. I do want to. And the other thing about Los Angeles.
Well, next year I'm going to run the marathon one more time, the New York City Marathon. So I'll run it next year.
Yeah.
So you're on. You have to run it with me.
What?
Yeah.
Are you dropping a challenge?
We're building.
Oh, shit. You just made it about charity. That's not fair.
It's for the children.
I'm like, that's not fair. Yeah, but these people don't have a hospital. But it's not fair that you're going to make me run.
Exactly.
I mean,
it's a whole day out of my life.
Yeah. I mean, God.
Sore.
No one has it harder than me. Okay. I guess we'll run for your hospital so people can live.
Exactly.
Is it a 26 mile marathon?
They all are, unfortunately.
And that is also a half marathon. So this is like a full marathon.
Yeah, but you only need, like, if you have 16 weeks, you can train for it.
How do you train?
You do 4 runs a week, basically, and the 3 of the runs are not very long necessarily. And then basically on the weekend, you do a longer run. And every weekend, you do, like, a build-up, like, you'll start at 6 miles the next weekend, 7 miles the next weekend, 8 miles. And then you'll go back, and then you'll go 7, 8, 9, and then you'll go back 8, 9, and you eventually get up to a 20-mile weekend.
Yeah,
and that's all you have to do. You don't have to. You don't have to do anything exceptional other than that.
Well,
a long run on the weekend.
I don't think I run the smartest way because usually I have so little time that I go, shit, I have a half hour, so I'll go onto a treadmill and run for, you know, like 25 minutes at 8 miles an hour.
Well, that's great. But that just means you'll have that to draw from, you know, because all you're doing is getting your body used to running that distance.
Okay.
You don't have to have done... No one does that distance.
When's the date of this? When's the date? I don't know what that's...
It'll be the first Sunday in November, a year from now.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I can commit to that because that's a year away.
No, no, commit to it. You can be on our team.
Oh, shit. You have a spot. Oh, my God. That's amazing.
No, because I'll do it. Yeah.
Oh, fuck. That'll be fun.
We'll do it. It'll be a good group.
Holy crap.
This year we have 60 people running on the Shoe for Africa team.
Yeah.
And we do, I have a big pasta party here the night before. And it's great. It's a good group.
Oh, that sounds...
But it's also something you can do training-wise individually wherever you are. And we have a program. You follow the program. You get it done.
Will I get ripped?
Your
will
first,
I get rock hard
my
abs?
Last. It'll be great.
Oh, my gosh.
Literally passing the torch.
It's probably going to be my last, too. I mean, I'll do... I just think it's like we said, like, yeah, one, I got it. I'm good. You know,
and then you'd be like, oh, but I could do a little better.
I could do like 5 minutes faster.
Yeah. Chicago. It's fun. What's awesome is to be with 40,000 people all going the same direction. You really are. Like, the marathon's the easiest part of it. If you can get to the training, the marathon is a piece of cake.
Yeah.
Honestly. Because running by yourself, doing 16 or 17 miles, and doing that, and not, that's hard. When you're like Sunday morning, maybe I'll do this on Monday.
What are these, like, I always feel like, oh, there's going to be some Argentinian guy who's going to run it in 2.5 hours.
You have to be prepared the fact that there'll be quite a few 65-year-old women that will pass you. it's like, nothing against 65-year-old women.
But
if you have any kind of ego problems in relation to...
Checking at the door.
Yeah. My friend George Hirsch, who's 70 years old, literally saw him at like mile 21 on the last time I ran. He's like, hey, Andy, how you doing? I'm like, good. He's like, see you later. He was gone. I'm like, George.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah.
I didn't even get to talk to you about ER, which it also was... How was it fun? Did you like it?
It was 8 years.
It was 8 years of it.
It was great. It was great.
I mean, I guess that's a dumb way to ask that question.
No, I mean, but it was, I mean, you know, I sound like in like howdy doody, but my son was born in January of 1994.
Yeah.
We did the pilot in March.
Yeah.
We started the show in July, and then I did 8 years straight, right, of that. And in that time, had 3 other kids.
Whoa.
I had a makeup company, and, you know, that's what I did. I mean, it was insane, like the amount. I had no idea how much work it was until it was all over, and, you know, came to New York, moved to New York, and was like, oh, geez, who am I? And, because all that medical dialogue and all that was, you know, it was challenging. It just required a lot. And also, you don't have kids.
No.
When you start having kids, it's like, it's all, you know, it was great that I played a sleep deprived, stressed out doctor because that's what you are. So I didn't have to, you know, I didn't have to Starsky and Hutch it up.
So you're sleep deprived and you're constantly having to keep someone alive. I guess when you have kids, your house is like an ER ward.
Yeah, so the truth is, it was like, and I'm realizing again now, I mean, working's easier than raising kids. Mm-hmm. So going to work was actually kind of a nice break to be able to be with adults and do that and play and pretend and have all that fun. And it made me also kind of not have it be any more precious than it had to be.
Yeah.
And we had a great group of actors there and a great group, you know. None of the problems on that show happened on the set. It was a really happy, fun place to be.
It was cool.
It was that funny thing of like, I mean, it's not that Friends was dark or anything.
Right.
But they started the same time we did. And it would like, if you visited the sets at different times, it was very different. Like our set was like fart jokes and people like putting shit on stuff and, you know, it's just like fucking around, because then when the cameras were rolling, we're like, your child just died, and I'm gonna rip it. You know? So it was like total heaviness. So juxtaposition was like nutcase. And then you like, you go to the friend's place and like while they're rehearsing, they're like, okay, this is how, you know, they were serious comedians, like,
right,
doing serious, and then made people laugh, you know,
right? But also everyone on that show though just sort of became their own little mini industry separately.
Right, and in sitcoms, I mean, that's a different world.
Yeah.
Because they have a different schedule and everything. You know, we're doing kind of 12 hours every day.
Right.
No, we never got that, you know, a read-through day.
Right.
So, not that it's any harder what we were doing necessarily as an actor, I don't think, because those guys are great comedians, obviously, and that's really difficult stuff. But, It was fun. It was really, I have to say, for 8 years, I had a really good time. I always enjoy going to work. The scripts were always challenging. It was, you know, it was great that way. So I had no regrets.
ER finally ended recently, didn't it?
Yeah, after 14 or 15 years. So they did 70, yeah. When I moved to New York, too, I had that awful experience of living where we live here on the Upper East Side, where I'd go in the street and people are like, why'd you leave the show? I'm like, well, I want to be, you know, with my wife and kids and, you know, raise. I don't care about your kids. I want you on the show. Like, good, angry television fans why'd in New York. I'm like, I don't give a shit about your private life. Entertain me on Thursday nights and don't leave.
Like, it is. I know it's such a, and I don't mean to stereotype all New Yorkers, but there is such a great, but like I was driving here and the car that I was in was, I don't know what was happening. Like a construction guy was trying to back a car out or something. And we were just stuck in traffic. And there was just a guy who, there was literally nothing we could do, but he was just standing yelling at our driver, dickhead, dickhead. Like, I don't, there's not anywhere we can go. Yeah, where do you think it's not happening?
It's great. Absolutely. Everybody's in everybody's business.
And it's weirdly, and what's funny about it is that, I guess just because of New York, you go, you know, if that happened in L.A., you'd be like, I'm going to get out. Why the fuck? What is your problem? You know, like, but here you just go, it's New York. You know, it's okay.
And the nice thing about it in New York is that it's probably a better percentage that people aren't armed.
Yes.
Like, in L.A., you're always thinking, they probably have a gun in there.
I'm going to get shot. It's like, I'm just going to get shot. I'm going to let it go.
Yeah.
You don't keep a place. You don't have a place in L.A., though, right? You're totally here.
No, we're here. We're here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we go out there in the summers, and we did keep a place down on the beach that we go to and visit, but not in LA proper.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your show. It's mid-season show. Yes?
Mid-season show. Zero Hour.
Zero Hour.
It's kind of the last. I mean, it's the classic, like, I'll never do a one-hour network series drama again. That was something that was like cut to 10 years later. This is a good one. I'd really not wanted to do a series for any other reason than selfishly could stay and play with my kids and learn to cook and do other things and do little movies, and I've been having fun. But then about a year and a half ago, my kids were giving me that look like, get out of the house. You're annoying us. I got offered to do Carnage, the play, I thought, oh, well, and I started wrapping my head around the fact of like, oh, yeah, I could go back. I could do that for 4 months or 6 months. And I thought, well, if I could really wrap my head around going back to work for 4 or 6 months at a time, why not do the series? So I have a development deal at Paramount and CBS. And my partner and I then started actively looking for something to me. We've been developing things for other people to do. And we started looking for it. And I thought it would be like a half hour, like a Showtime or a cable, something where I'd do 13 episodes a year. You know, something a little more in my mind manageable. And we developed something that we thought was great, and the Showtime took it all the way up to the end, but then didn't make it. And I was kind of shocked, because I really thought that was the one that was going to go and do it. And so then all of a sudden, I was kind of, my manager was like, well, let's read other things. So I started reading other things, and Lorenzo de Bonaventura, who I worked with at Warner Brothers years ago, and they sent me the script, and my manager was like, you might like this. And it's totally got me, because it's just like something I haven't seen on television before. I've seen kind of movie versions of it or read books like it, because it's kind of that Da Vinci style thriller. It's like a conspiracy thriller, and it's modern. And when I'm reading it, I'm like, A, I don't have to play a doctor. B, I don't have to play a policeman. C, I don't have to play a lawyer. Like, that's a trifecta. Like, that's, you know, it's going to be normal dialogue. You know, once again, as I get called in for these things, it's, you know, you're every man, because that's my fate, which is people are like, you remind me of my cousin.
Right.
You know? So that's.
Oh, I get that too.
Yeah.
Oh, you're my friend Craig.
Yeah. So we're of that ilk. We're like normal.
White guys.
Yeah, white guys. White guys. A bit nerdy.
A bit nerdy. We're nerdy white guys. Yeah. Like, we're the friend.
Right, exactly.
We're the friend.
Yeah. They want to sleep with the other one, but they'll marry you.
Yeah, exactly. Later in life, later. After they've been broken.
Yeah, exactly.
Then you'll come and help clean up the mess, rehabilitate them.
And they can step
Then they'll leave you again.
Yeah.
And you'll take it.
Yeah. I said, you know, and then I did my first way of getting out of things by saying, I love this script, but, you know, if it goes to series, we have to do it in New York because I'm not going to move. And they were like, yes. So I went, okay. actually, it did make me happy because I liked it. And I then talking to the writer is out of his mind. It's Paul Schering, who created Prison Break. Mm-hmm. And he's like, Mr., you know, knows a lot about everything and has, you know, is really into multiple layers of plot and, you know, it's much smarter than I'll ever be. And I can't figure it out half the time. But, you know, it's just that one, it's just a great setup for, you know, I'm married to Jacinda Barrett and mm-hmm. she, you know, in the pilot, she gets kidnapped and we're off to the races. Like, why are you after my wife? And this conspiracy thing starts unfolding. That just, we're shooting episode 6 now. And we just, you know, every time we get a new script, we're like, no way! Really? So, you know, I mean, whereas some shows, because we're going to be able to tell this whole story in 13 episodes, they're not having to think like, oh, we have one gag, which our show's based on, and we have to make this last for 5 years.
Right.
Like, no, we're going to make this story last for 13 episodes. So they're really, like, every episode, major things are happening. And that's the most fun of it, because I feel like, well, we should have a good shot doing this, because if we do it halfway well, as good as the script, then I know it'll at least be entertaining.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's just up to the gods of the networks, whether they put it in the right place or the people were ready for it, or, you know,
they give it a chance.
Yeah, I don't know, but I mean, I have a feeling like if something's good and it's the right time, people, you know, it'll last or it'll go. But
yeah,
if it's,
I don't know, you have a good attitude about everything, because it's like, you know, if it doesn't work out, I get to be with my family, or we'll travel more.
Yeah, I'm a little lucky that way.
It's pretty neat. It's being able to come into this business without that sense of desperation of like, I hope this is the thing. I really need this to be the thing. Like, that's such a fucking horrible place
but
to
it's be. Also that's the trick of what we have to do. And you have to do it more as a comedian than actors, because you don't have the character to hide behind. So when you're up there, your ability to make it look easy is what is your greatest talent. And that's what people don't understand. And they don't need to understand that. Like, you know, when I watch the Olympics, I don't really want to go to every training session with that, with that, you know, gymnast. But when I watch them, it looks effortless. And I think, I can do that.
Sure.
Give me a balance beam. I'm there. I can do it. You know, and that's what we're supposed to do. So, you know, to eliminate desperation is really great, because it takes that weight off of everybody. I mean, that's the best advice you can ever give an actor. It's like, go get a job by acting like you don't want it.
Yeah.
Because all they want is for them to go, oh, fuck, we don't have to worry about this.
Right.
He's not worried about it. Like, he can do it. It's not a problem for them.
Well, I guess maybe, you know, part of it is because you think, you know, when you really want to do something, you go, oh, this is the only thing there is in the world. And then it sort of goes back to like, well, if you travel and you see the world and you kind of see what else is out there, you might go, oh, yeah, you know, of course it would be nice to have this career, but I'm not going to fucking kill myself if I don't get it, because it's, you know.
Right.
There are bigger things.
And when you're around it, and you know, and I was lucky when I started out, I worked with a lot of older actors. And the ones that had long careers, the ones who just genuinely loved what they did.
Yeah.
And loved their life. And they, you know, it wasn't the drama of every other part of the business where people are flipping out about whether or not their publicist did the right thing, or their, you know, manager did the right thing. And there's so much fear that people act from, as opposed to just like the joy of it. Like, hello, we live in America and we can pretend for a living. Like, you know, how bad could it be?
Yeah. Well, I think we're almost at the end of our hour. Oh, we're exactly at an hour.
Really?
This just flew by. and I still can't. Do you remember your speech from the end of Revenge of the Nerds at all? Do you remember any of it? Do you remember
what did he say? He said,
it's right after the Triumphs come in, and he hands you the microphone. He
gets thrown into the water.
He gets thrown into the water, and comes out. He's got to pick up the glasses. I just remember that tonight those bastards, they trashed our house.
Yeah, they trashed our house.
Why? Because we're smart.
Because we're smart? Because we're... Because
we look different? And then I think it's, is it, and then you say, I'm a nerd. I'm a nerd.
I'm a nerd, yeah, and I'm proud.
Yeah, I'm pretty proud of it.
I'm pretty proud of it.
And then Carradine comes over.
I'm a nerd, too.
I'm a nerd, too. Yeah. Anyone who's felt picked at like that, and then fucking Queen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We are the champions.
Like, oh.
It's so goofy and so dated.
It's really, really.
But the message is still there.
Yeah, always, yeah. As it was in Euripides. Sophocles.
Revenge of the Nerds could have been like a Greek comedy.
It was only.
It really could have
tragedy.
Been.
Tragedy.
Comedy tragedy. Well, thanks for having me over to your house. And we're going to fucking run it up.
Okay. Well, that's it. So, yeah.
I come back to New York, I feel like, every week or every other week.
Well, so. I'm here all the time. And I generally... I'll run in the mornings because as the week goes on, it's always like my calls get later and later.
What about in the winter? Can you run in the winter?
Yeah, it's great in the winter. It's great. I run. You can run all year round.
What?
In the snow.
This is crazy information.
Yeah. No, it's great.
Okay, we'll do it.
Even better.
All right. Thanks, Andy. It's nice to see you.
You too.
Enjoy your burrito, everybody.
Nerds.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.
Do you ever wonder what your teenager is going through when they're preparing to leave home and enter the real world? I'm Shima Liai, and in my new podcast, The Competition, I'll give you an inside look into the pressures and expectations high school girls have to face.
I think I need to make a good first impression, or at least an impressive first impression.
We're going to follow 50 teenage girls as they spend 2 weeks in Mobile, Alabama, competing in the largest cash scholarship competition exclusively for high school girls. You'll hear the silly, intimate moments.
Why are you so amazing?
Like, I want to be you guys.
And the anxiety that comes with being an ambitious girl in America.
My whole life, I've told myself that I need to be a 35-year-old professional.
Is the pressure too much to handle? From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.